Welcome in, everybody, to the Locked On Nuggets podcast. I'm your host, Adam Matas from DNVR. A somber edition of the Locked On Nuggets podcast. Maybe one of the more difficult days as just a sports fan for me personally is Kobe Bryant passed away today in a helicopter crash. I don't even know why I'm recapping that. I'm sure everybody listening to this knows that news by now. Just to kind of set the tone, I mean, obviously this was a really, really tough one for me, to be honest with you. And I'm going to spend a lot of today's show on this news. At least the first segment. I will get to what happened in the Nuggets-Rockets game. But I guess I have to apologize up front just about being a little bit, I don't exactly know where to go with this episode. It's probably going to take me a lot of different takes, to be honest with you. I'm not a person that gets emotional at celebrity deaths. In fact, I don't think I ever have really felt this way about a celebrity death before. It's not that I'm not affected by them. You know, movies, music, athletes, whatever. It's just that it's always compartmentalized, I think, for me, or at least always has been. But Kobe was different for me in tonight, and I think all the circumstances just coming together to make this such a night I'll obviously always remember. But Kobe Bryant played a really important role in sort of my appreciation and just falling in love with the game. He was my favorite player. This might come as a surprise to, I think, a lot of people. He was my favorite player in the years of my life that I was playing and training basketball the hardest and the most. And every day, he was a big part of what made me want to be a great basketball player and in a lot of ways, a student of the game. And I think my relationship to Kobe in that vein, I think it allows me to relate to NBA players, at least in this one very specific way, because Kobe Bryant was the most influential player on today's players in the NBA. And I think really overwhelmingly for positive reasons. And I'm going to talk about that a lot. You know, watching him, I was in college playing college basketball down at Colorado College from 2002 to 2006. And those were, especially the back half of that, those were the years that Kobe was really reinventing himself and that second chapter of his career, second half of his career, where I think the Kobe that we all know and sort of so many of us sort of idolized as a basketball player, that second half, it really began around 2005. And what I think Kobe's, you know, for me at that time, Kobe was just so technically sound. I mean, I was a guy that really loved the game. And when I, you know, grew up in a part of town where there wasn't necessarily great basketball, was fortunate enough to be on some pretty good, feeder programs, as they were called back then, AAU programs, early on, and got sort of in that pipeline of, okay, you're going to be at the best camps and doing all this, these different things here, at least locally to Denver. But it wasn't until I went to college, and really it wasn't until but the summer before my college, that I first got to work with some very high-level, like, individual trainers, like one-on-one guys that were really opened my mind to just how much more the game of basketball had to offer. It was a simple game to me all the way up through that. And then around 18, after graduating from high school, realized how deep you can go with the game. And at that same time, I think Kobe was sort of going off in his own direction and taking the game in a whole new direction. He was inventing new moves. He was inventing new footwork, perfecting footwork. I think what I admired most about him was he seemed to have turned basketball into both an art and a science, something that could be studied scientifically and perfected. And, you know, that was a very attractive idea to me. Like, watching his footwork and his heyday, and then slowing it down. And this was before YouTube, but you can, you know, pause, you're watching videos of him, you know, the DVDs of Kobe, or you're watching different moves on SportsCenter, and you're just trying to memorize the little footworks that he did and then go to the gym and practice them. He was he was, and I think to this day, the single most skilled player to have ever played. If you know, you were to break down every skill into like a category, he had great post footwork. He had great footwork out on the perimeter, great pick and roll footwork, had a great shot, fall away, attacking the basket, left to right, right to left. He was a guy that had spent his whole career, I think, becoming a black belt in basketball. And I think for me as a person and as a, at the time, you know, 21 year old young adult just coming into my own, I connected to that, quite a bit. And, he more than any other player to this date, I think, inspired me and sort of, you know, it made me want to go out and work on my individual parts of my game. There are other players that I think influenced the way I thought about the game from more of like a 5-on-5 standpoint. But he was the guy that, you know, if you think about it, you don't go to the gym and pretend to be LeBron. You don't go to the gym and pretend to be Shaq. You can go to the gym and pretend to be Kobe. And it was because of just how sound he was and his influence that he had on players today. I think we take for granted sometimes where the league is right now. In fact, I know we do take for granted. It's one of the reasons I love this job is I hope you can feel my passion and my love for the game. And I hope that some of that rubs off on you and you feel and you fall in love with the game. But I think that's one of the things that defines Kobe's career. For all of his, you know, being a psychopath and a killer and Mamba mentality and this or that, he was a guy that so intensely loved the game of basketball and wanted so badly to be perfect at it. Perfect. Like, he didn't want to be really good. There was always something he could be better at with his game. And he just, he just loved it so much. And I think he infected me in a lot of ways with that same love. And I think he infected a lot of the players that you see in the league right now. There was a time not long ago, we're in the year 2020. There was a time in the early 2000s, late 90s, early 2000s, where I don't think players had that love and that passion. And your superstar players, you know, maybe showed up to out of shape, you know, it was a frequent thing. Guys didn't work on their games or develop. Guys didn't necessarily respect the game. And Kobe, I think early on in his life or early on in his career, you know, there were some real faults with him, both as a person and as a player. And I mean, some that if you would have asked me in 2002, if Kobe was going to go on to be this incredibly influential player, I would have said, oh, great, influential in a worse way. But I think it changed for him because he so obsessed about basketball and so obsessed about the work aspect, and not just obsessed about it, he found a way to fall in love with the work aspect of basketball in a way that I think is just so truly beautiful. And I think so many other players in the league have grown to sort of take that from him, including LeBron James. You know, that 2008 Redeem Team that went to the Olympics and won the gold medal after the U.S. had lost it in 2004. You know, the stories that came out of that were all of the young pups, Dwayne Wade, Carmelo Anthony, LeBron James, these guys all saw how hard Kobe worked and how just competitive and intense and serious he was. And I think it changed something in all of them. And I think those guys being, you know, the premier players, just everybody sort of, it trickled down into the whole league, this idea of, you know, you're lucky to be an NBA player and you've worked hard to get there. But if you want to be great, it takes 24/7, 365 to be that. And I think when you look at the league now and you look at how talented these players have become and how hard they work and how it's a culture, I would say the NBA has become a culture of work. Now, it's not everyone. There's still players that don't work on their game. There's players that don't improve or play the right way or whatever, lack some certain fundamentals. But I think if you compare it, especially to the generation before, it really 90s, 2000s, whatever, I just think the number of players that really just approach the game with passion and love and discipline and a desire to make themselves as best possible, you know, it's underrated and understated. And the last thing to that point, there might be some people listening to the show, you know, over the age of 45 or so, or maybe there's people tuning in for the first time to listen to this one that, you know, sort of wonder, you know, you hear so much about, oh, these guys, these players today are lazy and they don't play defense and this or that. And I, you know, if you listen to me long enough, you know, I really despise those takes. I think they're uneducated. I mean, I know them to not be true. I know them to be inaccurate. I think there's always some coded language and coded thoughts, you know, in when people are saying that. But what I like is, you know, we have one of the things that really bothers me about the way the league is covered right now is you do have a lot of old heads, Charles Barkley, Shaquille O'Neal, Kevin Garnett. You got a lot of these old timers who are either out of insecurity for their own era or just in a desire to sort of bolster themselves up, continually talk poorly of the league and continue to complain about things. And then, you know, Charles Barkley, I think, who I really love, and I enjoy watching his analysis when it's not this negative, you know, sort of hot takey view of it. You know, he's a guy that never really learned and evolved with the game. I mean, his simple, the basic things like not understanding why teams shoot more threes or post up less today, or when how the post game has evolved with rule changes and skill development and different things, like contrasting that to what Kobe has done. And with Kobe's, you know, he's only been out of the NBA for 4 years, but, you know, he is a guy that all these players look up to. And today, you know, in the locker room, I'm going to talk about that a little bit more at the end of the show, but in the locker room today, Monte Morris, Will Barton, you know, other guys, even in the other locker room, you go to the Rockets, you got Austin Rivers, you got all these guys who have said, yeah, Kobe has really, you know, talked to me for an hour in the hallway one time or met me at a restaurant, and he was like, yeah, let's just talk, let me break down your game, I'll inspire you. Of course, Kobe, you know, he does his film study and it's very high level stuff. I mean, Kobe really has taken the time to understand not just the game of his era, but the game today as it's being played, and is always propping up the new players of this era. It's ironic, I think, in a way, and in the saddest way, that, you know, LeBron James just passed him in total points on Saturday. And there was a big, you know, it was obviously a big moment. And he was interviewed for it. Bill Plaschke had a great thing in the LA Times where he talked to him about it. And he said, well, how do you feel? You know, this guy, LeBron James, a rival of yours at one point, is now passing you while wearing, you know, a Lakers jersey, your team's jersey. And he said, look, man, that this stuff is all in the past for me. My career's over. Like, that book has been written. And he had this great line that to me just sums it all up. He said, greatness, he tells Bill Plaschke this, greatness wasn't worth anything if you couldn't share it. And in all of the quotes, I encourage people to go check out the article, but all of the quotes that he had for Plaschke about LeBron sort of passing him, it wasn't this thing of, oh, I'm better than LeBron. It was this thing of, the league is in such a good place and I want to continue to make it an even better place. And to me, this is why it bothers me so much when the old heads, who I love, Charles Barkley, Kevin Garnett, these guys are like some of my favorite players from my youth. What bothers me so much about it is that I think players that were privileged enough to make millions and millions of dollars and get to have the life that they got to live in the fame and the competitiveness and getting to play basketball, I would give anything to be able to train for basketball for 8 hours a day. When you get that, I think you owe it to preserve it and to pass it on and to understand this like emotional investment that allows you that and sort of forces you to understand where the game is going and where these guys are. And I thought Kobe more than any other player sort of embodied that. And it's surprising to me because Kobe was a guy that, you know, thought he was better than everyone. I thought for sure he would become a curmudgeon. And I think he was influenced a bit by Michael Jordan. I mean, Michael Jordan famously didn't want to work with any player, you know, kind of isolated himself and didn't want to be a mentor. In fact, in some certain cases was discouraging to young players that came to him for advice, including LeBron James. And I think Kobe saw it opposite and maybe learned from those experiences. And he was so gracious in his post-playing days with trying to help other people. And to me, that more than, you know, there's a lot of things that really suck about this day and about this moment, but the thing that sucks, you know, from a basketball, just from the NBA standpoint, is that I think Kobe was on pace and on track to be just such a great ambassador for the game. I thought he was going to be, I can't believe that he's gone. It just doesn't seem real. It feels like a really bad nightmare, a bad dream. I could barely watch the Nuggets playing tonight when I was at the arena. But one of the things that I just find so tragic is I thought he, and maybe he already pulled this off, but I thought he set the tone for how you're supposed to retire graciously and be around the game, but not in a way that's just negative and nostalgic and trying to put down, but in a way that lifts it up and sees your success doesn't end when your playing days are over. Your success ends when the next generation successfully carries the torch. And I thought Kobe just did such a gracious job of that. And it really sucks for somebody that loves the game as much as I do and appreciates how much he loves the game. It really sucks to lose that ambassador. Going to go through some notes here on the game because there was a lot that happened. I'll tell you, tomorrow, DNVR, we will do a podcast solely on Kobe, probably an hour-long roundtable type discussion. And I've got a lot more thoughts I want to share about Kobe and what he means in the sports landscape and just what this means. To me, this was the most shocking sort of like sports figure death I can ever remember. Maybe what I can imagine. Kobe was as popular and as famous and just as young as anyone I can remember passing like this. So I don't want to spend it all on this podcast. I know a lot of people want to hear my thoughts on this Nuggets game. So, but tune in. The Denver Sports Podcast, it'll probably be on that feed. But just keep it locked to DNVR so you can see. Podcasts are always free on DNVR, so you can download the app and you can always know when the latest podcasts come on. But if you have not, I highly recommend you subscribe to the Denver Sports Podcast. It's a great podcast every week what we do, and then we put special podcasts on there every now and then, and tomorrow will be one. But I'll get into some notes here, and then in the final segment, sort of take you inside the locker room and what I saw. The first note I have in here, the 4-5 pick and roll. I'll talk a little bit more about Kobe later on. 4-5 pick and roll. I asked Malone before the game about whether or not that action between Jeremy Grant setting the screen and Jokic as the ball handler, whether that had happened organically or whether it was something that was scripted. And he said a little bit of both. First of all, he said he really liked the action, but he said it was a little bit of both. And he said, to be honest with you, we've had more success in the organic ones, like where they've just, you know, read each other, set the screen and go, than they have on the ones that have been scripted. Nonetheless, I think it's a weapon, and I think it's a weapon going forward that'll really work. The backside timing is key, and I don't know when I'll have the episode of the list up, maybe tomorrow morning. I do have all the clips pulled, but today, early in the morning recording this and just so much other stuff going on, I'll probably put it off until the morning to put that up. I'm sure you'll forgive me for that. But the backside timing is key, and the Nuggets had a scripted play for that screen. It would have worked. Jeremy Grant had a wide open lane. Jokic saw him, but Barton was just late cutting through. So this being a sort of a new action, the timing of everything is a little bit off, and it didn't work out. But I think it's a real weapon going forward, and I think it's something Denver can go to. Jokic has been more aggressive than ever over this last, 7-8 games. He's ramped this up, obviously, since I think December 6th is the magic date this year when he started, kind of coming out of his funk. But it is really, over this last 5 or 6 games when Plumlee went down and Jamal went down, you could just tell that Jokic is feeling the burden of responsibility to, okay, it's my time, I got to take over, I got to win these games. And he's down in the post, he's going at the basket, he's passing up. Sometimes, sometimes Jokic will make, quote unquote, the right play. He'll kick it out when the double comes. But what he's been doing lately that I think is so encouraging is that even when the double comes, sometimes he'll still go up if he feels like he has an opportunity to. And why I like that, I mean, I think Jokic needs to make the right play more often than not. But I think he knows when you're playing alongside certain guys, Torrey Craig, Monte Morris was great tonight, Malik Beasley, but even some of these guys off the bench, sometimes you need to establish who the star is and who the dominant force is. And I just thought he's done a great job of not just taking the easy route out, but going at guys, drawing fouls, and getting tough buckets, and he's doing just a bang up job of it. I mean, he's playing like an MVP caliber player. Jeremy Grant's offensive rebounding has been so key. I mean, he's been really good at it over these last couple games. And I don't know how many did he have in this one. I think just 2. But he was he's just around the basket a lot more. And I think for Denver to be successful, that's what they need. He clearly seems to have known this. If you look at Jeremy Grant's sort of last handful of games, just in January alone, he's got a 3-rebound game, a 2-4 rebound offensive rebound games, and a 6 offensive rebound game. Those rank among some of the high in his career. In fact, 6 is his career high. That's the one that he got against New Orleans. But 4 has only happened for him about 10 times, and he got 2 of those over the last week and a half. So he's clearly made an effort to be down there, and to me it's really paying off. He's hanging out in the dunker more. He's being active at cutting and just trying to be around the rim, and then he's being physical and going for the boards, and I'm really encouraged by it. You know, I was very low on Jeremy Grant as recently as maybe a week ago, which I know that can sound a little bit reactionary, but it was the reason I was down on him was because of his help side defense, which I think he's also making some strides there, although it's still, to me, a big one of the things I'm really concerned about. But also the rebound. He's just never been a very big rebounder. Well, he's certainly making an effort to, and I think it's one of the major reasons that Denver has now won 3 of the last 4 despite playing a very, very difficult schedule. The chemistry is growing, but they've played more minutes over than any other duo on the Nuggets roster over the last 10 games, and it's still a net negative. So it's a slight negative. I think earlier in the season it was like a big one. Now it's a slight one, but that's at least something to kind of file away, that as much as those guys are playing better together, they still haven't quite been able to put together the great string, and maybe that's because they're playing a lot of minutes with Torrey Craig, which I think is a bad fit, but whatever, but alas. Michael Porter Jr., he just has the ability to hit shots that he's never practiced before. His first shot today, you know, he kind of has to lean to his right and fall to the side to shoot it. And it's just one of those things where guys, you can tell guys that have this like elite focus and touch. I think Jokic has this as well. But MPJ, that's certainly a shot he's never tried before. Nobody in their right mind would try like a leaning one-handed little like 7-foot shot, but he just has so skilled and such focus on scoring that he was able to knock it down. And to me, it's little things like that that make me say, yeah, that's the sign of a pure scorer, a guy that can just do stuff that you've never seen before, and he's probably never seen before. He's also an automatic bucket from 3-point line. He's shooting 43% on the year from 3, or 42.5%. And if you take that over the last 15 games, it's like 47% from 3. If he's wide open, I wonder what his wide open percentages are. I should probably look that up, because he right now to me is a dead-eye shooter. I have a take maybe at the end of the year. I've been telling people in private, but I'll couch it for a little bit later, but I'll share one part of it for you. I think Michael Porter Jr. is an elite three-point shooter, not just on a hot run. I mean, knock on wood. Just looking at his form, I told you this, the only thing I had confidence in him was that he was going to be a good shooter, but watching him now in game speed and him getting his legs under him, I think he's an elite shooter. And when I say elite, I think he's a 40% career three-point shooter or higher. I mean, he just has that ability in him. One, he's so tall you can't block him, and his touch is just so good that those makes, he goes 4 of 6 tonight from behind the three-point line, and those makes are all swishes. You know, they're perfectly through the net. So he's an automatic bucket on the spot of three-point shooting. The Nuggets were getting killed on the boards early on in this game. They did do some damage. You know, they got them back a little bit, you know, going, getting their own offensive boards. But they give up 15, a lot of those in the first half, and a lot of those on like 2 or 3 possessions where there's multiple opportunities for them. The crowd even like let out the biggest sort of groan on this one possession that lasted about a minute and a half. That's kind of been a thing. As much as Jeremy Grant, I think, has improved, especially as an offensive rebounder, still not great as a defensive rebounder. Torrey Craig makes some of the weirdest plays, stuff that doesn't happen to anyone else. He had one in this game where he tried to dunk it, held on the rim, and the ball still went in, got called for a goaltend. It's just like, I've never seen that before. Torrey Craig just has a way of doing things that are just so weird. Sometimes he'll like dribble in a weird thing and fall down, the ball fall. He just always, something about the way he plays is just so bizarre. The first play of the game, Jokic throws him an outlet pass, it hits him in the face. Like, there's something about Torrey is so off rhythm. Let's see what I got here. The Porter Craig duo, it's only played 63 minutes, so this is small sample size. This is like bad analytics, Adam. This is me doing a bad job. But the Porter Craig lineup has grabbed 35.5% of every available offensive rebound. To put that in perspective, the Denver Nuggets as a team lead the NBA in offensive rebound percentage at 30. They are 5.4% higher when those two guys are on the court, and I don't think it's an anomaly. Both Porter and Craig are elite offensive rebounders. They both stand outside and play primarily out around the perimeter. So you stretch the defense out, but then they have a great nose and athleticism for crashing the boards. I think there's something too. that duo, especially if they played the three and the four. So if you went with like a Jokic, Craig Porter, defensively, it'd be a real dangerous lineup. But offensively, you just get so many rebounding chances that I'm intrigued. Malone had a great challenge in this game. I always talk about coaches' challenge. Coaches like to save these for the fourth quarter. Something could happen in the fourth quarter, and I get that. I think it makes sense. But when there is a point to be had or not had, to me, that's the ultimate challenge. The best thing a challenge can do is either save points or give you points. And Denver and Malone used one in this one where Will Barton scored. They called an offensive foul where there was none. And it's like, yeah, it doesn't matter. It's only the third quarter. Use your challenge because that's 2 points. That's the best possible outcome from a challenge. MPJ's length is so valuable on the defensive end. Here's one take I am willing to share. I think MPJ is going to be a good defender for most of his career. He's lost, and he's less lost now than he was a month ago, but his mistakes defensively have more to do with him not understanding scheme and not thinking quickly enough. But his length and his athleticism alone just make him such a difficult guy to shoot over, such a difficult guy to dribble around. And those two things, I mean, that stuff matters. You make egregious plays and you give up wide open layup. It looks terrible. And it is terrible. So wide open layups, giving up wide open layups are terrible. But when, you know, the 70, 80, 90% of the time you're on defense and you don't mess up, if you just have the length and the positioning and the athleticism to deter people from getting to their sweet spots, that's so huge. And MPJ, I think, has that. He's just a super athlete with super length. And he's actually been, I think, the second best defensive rating over the last 15 games. He has, I think, the highest net rating of everybody that's played in all of the games. He's missed one, of course, but that qualifies for me. And he's been a huge positive. Despite all of his flaws, he's been a huge positive. Monte Morris was balling in this game. He deserves a huge shout-out. He knocked down some threes. He had a great run in the fourth quarter that opened it up. He was a +4. He had 17 points, 7 rebounds, 4 assists, just 1 turnover. He did have a steal and a block. He was 7 of 15 and 3 of 6 from the three-point line. Those are good numbers. Those are big-time numbers. I think a lot of people have been sort of wondering about Monte and why he hasn't been as good as last year. I think now getting some run with, you know, I think a lot of the problems with that second unit was the Plumlee Grant lineup, and I've talked about that. You put just one of them out there. In this case, it was for the longest time, it was just Plumlee. Plumlee goes down. Now it's just Grant playing some stretch five, which I like, by the way. I like him playing small ball five. You put him out there, and all of a sudden that second unit looks great, and Monte in particular looks great. So something, I think, for Denver to kind of hang their hat on. I think Denver's learning a lot with Millsap out and maybe even with Millsap and Plumlee out, learning a lot about how you can get a healthy rotation that can defend but more importantly can score when you only have two bigs. I think it's in today's NBA, it's just smart to have stretch lineups that play consistently because those tend to be your biggest punches. Even if they're not your biggest like workhorses, they can have a big punch in a little sort of in short bursts. And then having multiple reliable shooters is just such a killer. The difference in this game was a fourth quarter run the second unit made. I mentioned Jeremy Grant at three. Monte Morris, Malik Beasley, Michael Porter Jr. made up the rest of that, that trio of shooters. Monte knocking down his threes. Beasley's always knocking down his. I mean, Beasley, tonight he went 0 for 4, but you have Morris that goes 3 of 6 and Porter goes 7 of 6, or 4 of 6. So you end up getting 7 of 12. That's just great, great shooting. And then Jeremy Grant, who was also part of that group, goes 3 of 3. That's the difference. So often in basketball, if you can knock down your outside shots, you're going to win a lot of games, and Denver just hasn't had guys that can knock down shots or hasn't played. I should more say they haven't played lineups that have featured multiple shooters. Tonight they did with that second unit, and it paid off. MPJ was feeling it a little bit too much down the stretch. He shot a fall away off of that peel action that he fumbled the ball and then decided just to shoot a fall away because he'd hit like 3 threes in a row. I guess I don't mind it because he is a guy that gets on fire and you feel like he's going to make it, but there is something to MPJ's game where when he's feeling it, he goes to the fall away. I think great players, when they're feeling it, they keep playing the exact same way. They keep attacking. You don't just say, okay, well, I made 3 threes. I'm going to shoot another three or another tough shot. Maybe that means the defense is going to push on you. Maybe that means that they're going to send a different defender on you. You always got to read it. And I thought in that moment, he thought, okay, I'm on fire. I'm going to take the easy way out and shoot the fall away. Just a lesson for him to learn. Defenses push up against Malik Beasley in ways they do not against Gary Harris. And I think as a result, and then also Beasley has such a quick step, it opens up some backdoor lanes. Him and Jokic had a couple of those in this game, and it was like a blast from the past. And then down the stretch, and this is maybe a thing that gonna just mention it now, but it's maybe something that comes up a little bit later. The Will Barton, Nikola Jokic two-man game closed this game. I think they accounted for all of the points down the stretch, like all of the non-free throw points down the stretch, and it just was two-man action, pick and roll, one to the other. Barton hit some tough shots. Jokic hit some shots, but it was just working really, really nicely. So we all know the Murray-Jokic two-man game is going to be Denver's bread and butter, but it's nice knowing that Will Barton also has this great chemistry with Jokic and can handle those duties in a pinch. So those were the notes from the game. It was a really encouraging game for Denver to beat. I know that Houston was without James Harden, but to come out and play the way that they did, Jokic looked like a leader once again. He goes for a triple-double, his ninth of the year, 24, 12, and 11. He did have six turnovers. But you get huge performance. I thought this was the best performance of the year from Jeremy Grant. 8 of 12 from the field, 25 points, 4 rebounds, 3 assists. He just did a little bit of everything. And then, of course, Michael Porter, Monte, Malik, those guys also really good. Encouraging win for Denver. Really, really big one. Okay, going to wrap up here now by talking about taking you inside the locker room. I know a lot of people are probably curious what it was like. I'll tell you, it was a tough locker room. I mean, this hit guys really hard. It hit me really hard, as I'm sure you can tell. But it hit a lot of guys in the locker room really hard. I mean, Will Barton believes Kobe Bryant's the greatest player ever. He's talked about that quite a bit. He watches Kobe highlights before the game. He was he actually said, when he got the news, or when he saw the TMZ report, he actually called somebody that he would know, that he knew, and confirmed it. He had it confirmed before the media did, because he just has a connection to Kobe, so he was able to sort of find that out. That's how much, you know, he really idolizes Kobe. I was sitting in the cafeteria at Pepsi Center for the media cafeteria, and I saw the report come through, and it just was. I was sitting there on my phone, and you know, Matt Moore's around, Harrison Windsor, Brendan Vogt, a bunch of media's around, and the report comes in, and it just didn't seem real. And I was like, man, what is going on? Is this accurate or not? None of us could kind of figure it out, and it had only been on the timeline for maybe 30 seconds. And I thought to myself, I got up. I usually sit there and have dinner before I go out there, and I thought, I need to go out there. I need to see what's happening outside. And I go out. I mean, the news is now a minute old at most, and I'm walking down, and I stop one of the assistant coaches Stephen Graham, and I say, hey man, have you seen this? And he takes a look at it. He goes, are you serious? Is this confirmed? Jeremy Grant walks out. I stop him. I say, hey man, you see this? And same thing. He's like, is this real? Does anybody know is this real? Mason Plumlee style. Next thing you know, you have a scrum. And long story short, I was breaking the news to the players in the hallway as they're going to get their warmups. Everybody beelined, you know, immediately stopped what they were doing and beelined for it. This was this news dropped about an hour before tip-off, but it wasn't even confirmed till about 40 minutes or so before tip-off. And I'm telling you, everybody's routine was disrupted. I was on the court. I walked out from the hallway after telling those guys out to the court. Jamal Murray's getting his shots up. Will Barton comes running out to the court, and he grabs him, and I'm standing right there. He grabs him, and he says, hey, Kobe died. And Jamal kind of takes his earpiece out and is like, what are you talking about? There, the arena, all these basketball people like myself, the arena, I mean, it really was a dark cloud over the team. Players were crying. I think you guys saw the videos of some of the Rockets players, but Nuggets players as well. This hit everybody really, really hard, and it was impressive, I think, that they were able to go out and play and to perform at a high level. This wasn't a bad game. I thought everybody was going to shoot 30%. It was going to be ugly, a million turnovers. Guys played hard. Guys played focused. And again, I think this is a credit to Kobe that, you know, his legacy. There's a lot of players that are like, you know, this is what Kobe would have wanted to be. To honor him, we got to be competitive. It's a credit to him. But post-game, I mean, there was just a cloud over that locker room like I'd never seen before. Michael Malone, of course, addressed the crowd right away. I mean, so first of all, there's no media there except for the regular guys, about 10 of us that cover the team every single game. Do the pregame routine. There's 10 people there. I show up for the postgame routine, And there's 50 people there. All these camera crews had come in, you know, all your local stations, all your local reporters from the newspapers or whatever that don't usually come to Nuggets games, they all show up. And it was just it was the weirdest mood, the weirdest environment. Nuggets had just won a big game, a tiebreaker game against Houston, and everybody was – there was just this cloud over it. And then, yeah, like I said, in the locker room, you know, Malik Beasley sat quietly for the longest time. Will Barton took probably an hour to address the media. You could tell he didn't want to. You know, he wanted to talk. He always enjoys talking to the media, but he needed that much time to sort of prepare. Jokic spoke immediately. He usually goes and works out. I think he chose this time instead to get it out of the way as soon as possible and then go on with whatever it was he was doing. I think he stayed around to work out afterwards. Everybody just kind of broke their routine, and everybody, you know, there wasn't any joking around in the locker room, even with media members like there usually is. It really did the gravity of the situation. I don't think anybody will really forget where they were this night. It does not seem real. It's even for me, it's gonna be a thing that I think lingers and sort of stings for quite some time. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. Like I said, check out the Denver Sports Podcast tomorrow. I'll be on it with some of my colleagues over at DNVR. An episode list should be up at some point tomorrow. But a lot to sort of unpack with this, and I think the impact of it. Even if you weren't a Kobe Bryant fan or don't agree with me that his impact on the league was as massive as it was, I think everybody's going to see this story isn't going away. This is going to be the story of the year in sports, and one of the stories we'll remember, I think, for the rest of our lives. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. I will be back again tomorrow with a brand new episode.
Because you hear a lot of stories about how he's non-approachable and he's cocky and he's arrogant, but he was the complete opposite, man. He gave out advice to anyone that seek knowledge. Real personable guy. Good person to have any time I ever ran into him. And, you know, it's just tough.